It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, corporations these days seem to be speaking out on political and social issues more and more often. We'll find out what's behind the current wave of corporate activism. First, if you were to dump out all the contents of your home, how many things would you have if you had to guess? There's no judgment here. Our producer, J. Carlisle Larson, stopped counting after she reached 100 things around her desk alone. According to some statistics, the average American home has some 300,000 objects within its walls. As people, we have a messy and complex relationship to stuff, whether it's clothing or books or toys and trinkets. These objects can sometimes hold an incredible sentimental value, and stuff can inspire a whole range of feelings. Case in point. I know you're gone, and it's just a pivot out of sight. It's out of mind, and I'm not ready to say goodbye. 'Cause when it's love, it's not just stuff. Song literally called Stuff by singer Kaylee Rose. It outlines how difficult it can be to get rid of things, in this case, after a breakup. Our next guest is here to talk about our emotional attachment to items and why we're primed to want to buy and hold on to stuff. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay and Oregon State University. Regan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
So psychologically, Regan, what makes us want stuff?
I think you can break it down and look at it from a couple of different levels. At the most basic level, I think stuff makes us feel good. It feels good to buy stuff, and often I don't think we can help it. We are living in a world that's engineered to make us want stuff. You turn on the TV, you look at social media, there, you know, you have various people showing their stuff, and it's hard to not want stuff once you see stuff. So I think, you know, it's really the feel good is at the heart of it, but I also think there's a very large component of us not being able to really help ourselves. And I know this varies a lot from person to person, but for many of us, there are certain things that we just can't help going out and buying.
I've seen some happiness studies suggest that we think a thing we buy is going to make us happier than it really does. There's an initial burst of happiness, but it fades pretty quick. Do you see that?
Well, absolutely. And that's something called habituation. I think we very often habituate to something that we have, and something brand new, whether it's a brand new pen that flows really well or a new piece of clothing or something like that may make us feel really good, and we may like looking at it. But over time, we get used to it. And as we get used to it, it doesn't have that same appeal anymore. I also think combined with exactly what you said and in those happiness studies, very often, especially if we want happiness, we're always looking for that silver bullet that we believe can give it to us. And if something doesn't work, we try and reach out for something else. And so we move on to something else. And very often, those some things that we try may work in the short term, but may not work in the long run, and we need to turn to something else.
And I don't want to overplay a drug addiction here, but do we need to escalate if buying that, I don't know, $5 item doesn't work the third time? Maybe we go for a bigger, more expensive thing that we think is going to make us happier.
Well, it's interesting that you say overplay the drug relationship, but I think at the most basic level, when we talk about pleasure, we're often talking about a chemical reaction in our brains. In this case, buying stuff is probably the easiest way for us to self-medicate in many ways. And you've probably heard of the chemical dopamine. And dopamine in general is regarded as the pleasure chemical. There are many things that we do that feel good. And almost always when you report or can say, oh boy, this feels good, it's accompanied by the surge in dopamine. So in some ways, that surge of dopamine, I mean, there is this drug making us feel good. And when we habituate to something, that something may not give us that same level of dopamine. So we do it a little bit more. And I think that often relates to buying things where, you know, maybe some of us need to buy things more often to get that shot of dopamine in our system.
Talking to psychology professor Regan Gurung about things and stuff, the things we buy, the things we keep, whether or not they make us happy in the short and or long run. Regan, we've heard the phrase self-care out there a lot lately. The idea being, hey, if you're feeling stressed in life, take some time to take care of yourself. Pretty good idea, I think. Right. But it seems like that's been captured by marketers and social media to have self-care equal pay money for a thing. Do you see that?
Right. And actually, there's an entire area of consumer psychology that looks at something called retail therapy. And, you know, you've heard the phrase, and there's actually psychological research done on what's referred to as retail therapy. And what it shows is that a significant percent of people, when asked, do you buy things to feel better? I've seen studies showing up to 65 to 70% of people saying, yes, I actually buy things to feel better. And I think there's the classic case of, I want to feel good. Well, let's go out and buy something and maybe that will help me feel better.
That's buying stuff so far. Let's talk about keeping stuff. And let's first key in on the sentimental value of some things. When do we start to imbue an item with an emotional connection for ourselves or maybe to someone else?
I think most often it's when that item is linked to an event or a person. So very often we link events or people to, you know, to music and very often items. So, for example, if you go to the Bay Beach Amusement Park in Green Bay and you buy this little souvenir and you were there with your best friends, every time you look at that souvenir, it's going to be associated with those memories of being with those best friends. And I think a lot of the things, as I look around my office or as I look around the house, very often there are things that we can remember when we got it and with whom we were when we got it. And it's those memories that make items something that we don't want to get rid of. Even when there's clutter, and you mentioned clutter in the opening, you know, the 100-plus items, well, a good chunk of them will have some meaning. And it's very hard to get rid of things that we have tied or tagged meaning to.
We see at the worst level people worried about hoarding, people storing too much stuff, even getting storage spaces. Even on a lesser level, even if we don't go that far, I'll say I keep a lot of stuff I don't need. I think my attitude is something like, well, maybe that random cord from an appliance 20 years ago will be useful someday. How come we want to keep stuff even if it doesn't have that sentimental or useful value?
Well, you know, I think here's the thing. I will bet that those things that you've kept for some day, even if there are 20 of those things that, you know, and you've never touched 18 of those things, two of those things you may have actually found a use for, and it reinforces your whole keeping it. And you go, see, I know, I knew I should have kept it. And I think that's very often when we talk about, when you use the word hoarding, there's also a psychology of hoarding, and that's a whole separate ball of wax where, you know, this may be control, it may be, you know, something more than just the I like how it looks or I like using it often. But most commonly, when we keep things, it's either its associations with positive things, or when it reminds us of good things, or this thought that we have that you nicely captured that we may actually need it at some point, so why get rid of it? Something that's much easier to do when you live in the same house or the same place for a long time. It's very easy to accumulate things and then put them out of sight so you don't have to deal with getting rid of it.
I want to throw one more angle in here as to why we buy and or keep stuff, Regan. The idea that our possessions are a way of self-expression. If I own this shirt, this car, this CD, if we still buy CDs, it says something about who I am.
Right. Well, you know, the fact that you mentioned CDs definitely says something about who you are. But, you know, I think there's associations. I mean, and brand and marketing, brands are... and advertising is geared to make you want a brand because of what it's associated with. So the brand of car that you drive, you know, whether you have an eco-friendly car, for example, again, that says something about you. The clothing that you wear says something about you. And it's very often, as human beings, we automatically decide who somebody is and what they're about based on what they own and the types of things they have. So that's not just this sake, oh, no, that's a superficial kind of thing. I think that's the way we are as human beings, looking for information about what somebody has and what somebody owns to give us a better sense of who they are.
We're talking to Regan Goering right now. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and Oregon State University. Regan, this Marie Kondo thing, I think is part of why we actually called you up in the first place. It's big. She's got a Netflix show, a book, and a lot of people are picking up one thing at a time saying, does this give me joy? If not, I should get rid of it. What do you think about this apparent trend?
Right. I think that's, you know, in the face of so many of us having so many things, there are many of us who would like to know, well, how can we do something about it? And especially when you take a look at a situation of a house full or an office full of things, where can you even start? Even contemplating trimming and culling what you have is stressful. And so this whole new trend, picking something up, it's a very pragmatic, simple, straightforward approach that seems like it could work. And, I mean, I know there are some of us who will pick up everything we have and go, yep, I do love it, you know. But that said, for the most part, we need to start someplace. And I think that's one very viable way of beginning to say, well, do I really need this? I think, you know, one of the things that are very simple along the same lines, it's also a question of not just looking at what you have, but before you buy something, stopping and going, do I really need this? And, you know, many of us parents use a trick with our kids where if they say they'd like something, I know something I use is say, hey, look, I know you like it. Why don't we wait 1 week? And if you still like it, then maybe we can think about it. And more often than not, a week later, you know, nay, a few days later, it's gone.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Paula with us in Spring Green. Paula, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Paula?
First of all, I am a psychotherapist, so I feel a little guilty even calling in and asking the question. However, I am guilty of having done retail therapy. I don't do as much as I used to because I am retired. I know some of the reasons I've done it in the past because I have felt good. And then I rationalize and justify the items I buy will either be useful, have a utilitarian function, or my daughter or son will want them at some point in their lives. They're adults now. But I am having problems decluttering and letting go, even though I have studied how to let go. Some of the items I've accumulated are works of art, and I find them to be more valuable than what maybe other people might. So that's my question. How do I let go of what I feel is valuable or things my adult children might like?
Paula, thanks a lot for the call. Paula, I'm assuming not alone out there, Regan, in having this kind of quandary.
Yeah, you know, and I think, Paula, you nicely mentioned, you know, a key point here, which is different things have different meanings to different people. And clearly there are some things that have a lot of meaning to you, but I bet there are other things that don't have as much meaning. And I think the question is, if there is something where you feel like there's a lot tied to it, not acting and getting rid of it right away is the key. Something that I've seen often suggested in the research literature is where in an effort to cut down on what you have, you take items, there'll always be things that when you look at it, you go, yep, definitely don't want that. And then there are those things that you're not that sure of. And then there are those things that you know for sure you do like. Well, don't touch that first category. But that middle category of, well, you know, I don't know. Well, keep those someplace separate. Keep those out of sight. Keep those someplace separate. Then go back to it a little later and see how your feelings have changed about it. And very often that taking those out of sight for a while makes you appraise their worth in a slightly different way than you would the very first time you look at it.
Paula, thanks a lot for the call and good luck. We'll go now to Anne with us in Green Bay. Anne, hello.
Hello. Well, the reason I have a hard time eliminating stuff is because I'm a big environmentalist, and if I can't repurpose it, I don't want it to go to a landfill.
Mm-hmm. All right. And does that have you tried to figure out creative ways to reuse stuff, Ann?
I do.
But I guess that has its limits. Regan, yeah, the concerns about what happens to the stuff when it's gone.
You know, I think Wisconsin's a nice place to live in terms of recycling and things like that. And over the last few years, there's been a great increase in venues for recycling and reusing a whole range of things. The big deal, though, and Anne puts her finger on this, is there are still a lot of items that you just can't put by the curbside because they'll be put to the landfill. And one major solution is to actually go to the internet, and you will find, and I found this in terms of things like car seats and things like that, even though there may not be always something available locally, there is something where you can send it to, and you may go, oh, well, I don't want to spend money to send it, but often that price is not that high, and it's a place that will really put that to good use. So that's absolutely a big thing to keep in mind, where you just don't want to ditch all, you know, plastic or things or certain things that aren't going to be picked up. But the good news is there are more and more places, but it does involve a little bit of internet searching.
And thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, psychology professor, looking at our relationship with the things we buy and own. It sounds like, Regan, maybe the triage should be something more like what you do with your kids. Figure out if we want it in the first place before we buy it, and then have to decide years later whether we want to get rid of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's really, you know, and actually going back to something Paula said, in terms of when you're retired and you have a different cash flow, it may be easier to say, okay, let's watch it, you know, more closely. On the flip side, the more time you have, the more likely you are to go around looking for stuff as well. So, you know, all these different factors can offset or influence your likelihood to buy something. But definitely the more you can put on yourself as that little waiting period, the more you can avoid maybe impulse buys or even mood-related buys. And mood's a big deal when it comes to buying things.
Got an email from Tom in Berlin. Tom says, last year I downsized. It felt so good to toss or sell so much stuff. Now I have, Tom writes, a business cleaning out homes and getting rid of the 300,000 items in each home. It's great exercise, fun, and profitable. Okay, so that's, and I'm guessing some people might have a similar experience where once you get over the hump and start purging some things, you feel like, yeah, it feels pretty good.
Well, and it's not just that, Rob. I think a key point, both in the trend that you mentioned, but also in the business just mentioned, is it's very hard for us to do it ourselves, but it gets a little easier if somebody comes and does it for you. Because, you know, you have somebody come in and say, okay, help me clear this up. We are much more likely to go, okay, I'm all with that. And for many folks, putting ourselves in the hands of our cleaning up company may take a lot of that emotional pressure and that stress off, and maybe the route to go for some of us.
Well, Regan, I want to pose a question that might be personal for you now. Say somebody who's getting ready to move, I don't know, from Wisconsin to Oregon, say, picking a place at random. How do we start to triage what to take with us and what to give up on?
I think moving is probably one of the best times to purge what you have, because there's nothing like a moving company giving you an estimate and going, hey, I don't think I want to take all that. But, you know, earlier on, Rob, you mentioned you've got all this stuff. Well, very often in a house that you've lived in for some time, you don't see all that stuff
yep.
that you have. And any way you can give yourself an opportunity to see all that you have automatically makes you realize how much you do have that you haven't really, that's been hidden away, and right there is a great incentive for cutting down on the stuff that you have and maybe not buying new stuff because you realize you actually have it.
Let's bring on one more caller. Ellen is with us in La Crosse. Ellen, hi.
Hi. I have a property, a cottage that was given to us by my father. And it's got multiple owners. It has some disrepair issues, but we're having a hard time trying to decide if we should get rid of it because of the emotional attachment or tackle repairs that are pretty expensive. And it is really difficult to make the thought of getting rid of the property.
Ellen, I'm guessing there's a lot of memories attached to this place as well, Ellen?
Oh, absolutely. Family memories of 3 generations.
Wow. Ellen, thank you so much for that. That sounds like a difficult situation, Regan, with a lot of memories attached to this very sentimental place for them.
Yeah. And you know, here's one of those situations where getting rid of it, especially with all that emotion attached, is probably one of the last options. And now, you know, entertaining any of the multiple ways to actually keep it in some form or the other, whether it's, you know, by extended family or friends or some way to keep it or even parts of it, that's a much better route to go before considering the getting rid of all those memories.
Ellen, good luck to you and your family members making that decision. And Regan, good luck to you. You are leaving UW-Green Bay, headed on to Oregon State University. I assume we'll still be in touch, though, right?
Absolutely.
Regan, thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck in your next adventure.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at UW-Green Bay for now, heading soon to teach at Oregon State University. He joined us today to talk about the complex and sometimes messy relationship we have with the things we buy and keep. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You may have noticed corporations these days speaking out on political and social issues more frequently. Recently, Disney's CEO suggested it would be very difficult for the company to continue filming in Georgia if the state's restrictive new abortion laws take effect. Elsewhere, a new policy from business software provider Salesforce bans companies from using their product to sell certain types of firearms and firearm accessories. These are just two recent examples of so-called corporate activism, and the lines that once divided business and activism seem to be getting more and more blurry. Braden King joins us now. He's the Max McGraw Chair of Management and the Environment at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. Among other things, his research focuses on how social movement activists influence corporate social responsibility. Braden, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Well, it seems like once upon a time, really overt public corporate activism, companies seem to steer clear of it. Do you see a big change happening in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we've noticed is for the first time, or I guess I should say it's becoming more common for the first time in recent years, that companies are starting to sign letters, make public statements to either support policies or to show their opposition to government policies that have nothing to do with their main form of business. It's common in the past for companies to take positions on policies that matter to their business model, but they've typically kind of stayed away from social issues or environmental issues that are really, you know, peripheral to what they do. So this is the big change we've noticed, is they're taking positions on things that really have nothing to do with their business.
Right. We see companies like Disney and Netflix saying, hey, we might stop filming in Georgia because of their new abortion laws there. That seems like something that could have the benefit of bringing on customers who agree with them, but really pushing away people who don't agree with that stance.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that it has anything to do with the customers themselves. Mm-hmm. I think that Disney and Netflix realize that, you know, their customers may, you know, that disagree with it may think about it for a few minutes, but in the end, if they like the product, they're going to, you know, go see the movie, or you know, they're going to stick with Netflix as a streaming service. But the group that really matters to both Disney and Netflix is their employee group. That is, they care about what the values of their employees, what they think about these policies, and whether they're comfortable, you know, working in an environment that is, you know, oppositional to their values.
Is that a trend you're seeing more, employee-driven corporate activism?
Absolutely. You know, I think part of this has to do with the generational shift. You know, maybe 30 years ago, employees did not feel empowered to talk about their values in the workplace, or they felt like that was just something you didn't do. Whereas today, I think it's much more common. You know, millennials in particular are a group that feel like, you know, it's important that their work life, you know, have some connection with their personal life, with what they think and believe personally. They want those two things to be compatible. And they're much more likely to kind of choose a job based on, you know, what on the company's values. And so you especially see in industries where, you know, managers or, you know, people have technical skills that are highly scarce and valued, that they tend to, you know, cater then to their employees' beliefs more so than industries that, you know, where it's mostly just, you know, a manual labor or that kind of thing.
Do we see different kinds of activism and different stakes for companies with a direct consumer-related brand. Oh, that's a Disney movie. I know it's a Disney movie. Or that's a Coke can. I know it's the Coke company. But if it's the Coke brothers companies, they don't have their product on a label. Is it different the more distant they are from the direct consumer?
Yeah, I mean, I think those companies have a little bit more at stake. You would think that it would make them more averse to engaging in this kind of activism. But what we're finding is the opposite. So a student and I did an analysis recently where we looked at, you know, what kinds of companies will put their names on these letters, you know, in favor or against government policies. And we found that they tend to be companies that have a lot of brand equity. But they're also companies that are known for good employee environments. So if you're a company that's received an employment award in the past, you're much more likely to support or to engage in what we call corporate activism.
You mentioned environmental issues earlier, and I know over the years there's been skepticism. People have the phrase greenwashing, the idea that companies put up a facade of activism, especially on environmental issues, but don't really do anything concrete. What do you see?
So it's definitely true that all companies now, I think, are trying to ride the green wave. And, you know, no company wants to sort of be seen as environmentally wasteful. And so they're all trying to do their best to position themselves as environmentally friendly. And for some companies, that just means that they are slapping a label on packaging of a product. And, you know, they might get some traction out of that. But that's different, I think, than companies that are taking stances on these issues. I mean, compare, for example, a company that, you know, puts a green label that says environmentally friendly to a company that actually, you know, signed this letter saying we want the United States to stay in the Paris Accord. The latter, you know, is a much more costly signal of what a company really stands for or believes in its core values, whereas, you know, just packaging something is, as you say, could be just a form of greenwashing.
Talking to Braden King right now from Northwestern University about the changing face of corporate activism. How has social media changed the corporate activism story, Braden, now that there's a corporate personality on Twitter and Facebook?
Yeah, well, in a couple of ways. One is it makes the corporate brand a lot more personable, right? So the company's Twitter accounts tend to have a personality to them that they didn't before. And with personality, you know, both comes the benefit of, you know, being able to share beliefs, which they do sometimes, but also the risk of, you know, saying something online that you later regret. And you see that happening quite a bit as well. So the other thing that has changed is that it gives activists, that is, you know, environmental social activists, a direct mechanism to target these companies. So the number of boycotts have been, you know, that are targeted against companies have been going up just by a huge magnitude in recent years. And the major change is just the availability of social media. Now it's much easier for activists to announce a boycott or start a, you know, an online campaign against a company because the costs of organizing are so low. All you have to do is have a Twitter account and have access to a network of people who agree with you on a particular social issue, and you can start a boycott overnight. So that's created a risk for companies where suddenly they have to be aware of all of the potential you know, voices out there that might have something to say about their company.
I know it might be hard to measure, but do we know if a corporation taking a stance, especially on a social issue, makes a difference? Does it change anyone's mind or change anyone's policies?
It's hard to know. We're, you know, that's something we're starting to look at. I think that it definitely seems to be influencing employees. So you can look at, you know, these surveys that they do at, you know, exit surveys at MBA programs or other similar kinds of surveys, and they find that, you know, that these people say that they are wanting to work for companies and are choosing their first job based on their fit, the cultural fit they have with the company. And, you know, included in cultural fit is whether they believe that company stands for the kinds of values that they have. And so, you know, if these statements are, you know, increasing fit, perceived fit with certain kinds of employees, that's a good thing and will probably have an effect on the quality of employee they can attract. But as far as, you know, consumer behavior, Any kind of study I've seen has shown that there's very little impact on consumer behavior. Even consumers who believe that they are making choices based on, you know, a political belief or the political stance of a company, there's just no evidence that it translates into how they actually shop, what they spend their money on. It turns out that, you know, consumers just like to buy high quality products for a good price, and that's the main thing that drives their behavior.
Is there any thought that consumers might be turned off by corporations taking political stances, whether or not they feel strongly about the particular issue?
I think that they will tell you they are, but again, I just don't think it translates into behavior. So we have a study that I've been doing with some colleagues at the University of Toronto and at Harvard University. And what we're finding is that consumers will tell you that they oppose the company and that they actually say that they boycotted a company. So take the Starbucks example. A couple of years ago, Starbucks came out and said they were going to hire 10,000 refugees as employees in response to President Trump's travel ban. So it was clearly a policy that was meant as direct opposition to President Trump's travel ban. And so a lot of Trump supporters were very upset about this. They were very vocal online, talked about how they were going to boycott Starbucks. And it, you know, became a big deal for a month or so. What we did is we tracked consumers' spending behavior, looking at their purchases, their receipts and such. And what we found is that people who watch a lot of Fox News and who said they voted for Trump are much more likely to say that they boycotted Starbucks during that period. But if you look at their receipts, those people who say they boycotted Starbucks bought just as much Starbucks as the people who didn't say they boycotted Starbucks. So people like to believe that their consumer choices are shaped by companies' political stances, but in reality, they're not.
When it comes to corporate activism, as we wrap up, is there an emerging story or trend you're keeping your eye on to see where it goes?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what's going to happen in this election cycle. I think that, you know, this matters a lot for a number of different kinds of companies. You know, one thing we know is that, you know, under President Trump's administration, it's become a little bit more difficult for companies, especially in the tech industry, to recruit people to work for their companies in the United States. And so I think that's one issue that's going to be on their agenda, is making sure that immigration reform is out there and being talked about. And then I think that climate change is going to be a huge issue, and you're going to see companies come down on this on opposite sides. You know, some companies are going to be quite vocal about being involved in the global solution to climate change, and then other companies are going to maybe more behind the scenes be advocating for less action on that.
Braden, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Braden King is a professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. He joined us to talk about corporate activism in America today and how companies are using it. The Trump administration is banning U.S. embassies around the world from flying the gay pride flag on their flagpoles. Earlier this month, American diplomats said that embassies in Israel, Germany, Brazil, Latvia, and elsewhere requested to fly the rainbow flag beneath the American flag, but were denied. Vice President Mike Pence confirmed that policy on NBC News last night.
We're proud to be able to serve every American. And we both feel that way very passionately. But when it comes to the American flagpole at American embassies and capitals around the world, having the one American flag fly, I think, is the right decision. And we put no restrictions on displaying any other flags or any other displays at our embassies beyond that.
Several embassies have opted to display the pride flag in other ways. Here in Wisconsin, Governor Evers declared that the rainbow flag would fly above the Capitol building for all of June, which is known as Pride Month. That's touched a nerve among some conservatives in the state. Kimmy King is a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Her areas of expertise include civil rights and liberties and administrative agency decision making. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be on public radio.
So national level around the world, here in Wisconsin, did you see the pride flag becoming a controversy this year?
No, and it's actually quite interesting. If you look at what case law has, there's actually more case law on what you can do to an American flag than there is case law on what to do if you want to fly a flag. But I would also point out that this is part of a larger issue. Think about all of the controversy about Confederate soldiers and Confederate flags. And so in that sense, it very much is a part of the debate that we've been having about symbolism and ideology in public spaces.
Now, some of the argument is what we just heard from Vice President Pence there. The issue isn't what flag. It's in some cases people want to say, hey, there should be just that one American flag over an embassy, or just an American flag and a state flag and maybe the POW MIA flag on the Wisconsin flagpole, and people not wanting to open the door to any other flags beyond that.
Yes, and actually one of the things that you see happening is that many cities are more directly affected by this and caught up in the controversies, and a number of them are scrambling to put policies in place so that they are not accused of being what we call, what we look for in the law, is being arbitrary and capricious about how you're approaching some issue. And so you're going to see a whole host of new policies come out about who gets to make the decision and under what circumstances flags can be flown.
Well, I want to give a listen or read out a couple of statements from our Governor Evers, a Democrat who wanted to fly the flag, and a Republican state senator. First, Governor Evers, in a statement, said, "Publicly displaying the Rainbow Pride flag sends a clear and unequivocal message that Wisconsin is a welcoming and inclusive place where everyone can live without fear of persecution, judgment, or discrimination." And then Republican State Senator David Craig, in a tweet, said, "The U.S. and Wisconsin flags are flown over us as unifying symbols for all Wisconsinites. The governor's action today is no doubt a statement to advance a cause. The only cause that the Capitol flag should represent is 50 states united in one republic." So the argument seems to be the pride flag is inclusive, or the pride flag is divisive.
Yeah, and understand that those are the exact same kind of arguments that we've been having about the Confederate flag. And one of the reasons why Confederate flags started being pulled down across the country, in a trend that began really in the 1990s of being pulled down, is because they were seen as being divisive. And so you see your governor trying to make a clear point that there's a distinction between what the LGBT flag represents versus other flags, which he knows or he has to have some reason to believe he's going to be challenged on. And it really strikes at your core ideology, right? It depends on how you see the Confederate flag or how you see the LGBT flag. And that's where the difficulty comes. I would also point out that part of the reason why there is this tension is because of a number of the policies that President Trump has put in place, which are perceived as being hostile to the LGBT community. And I think that's part of why you're seeing this backlash, is that it is also a slap in the face of the challenges and the rollback of advances that were made under the Obama administration that many, and some definitely, feel are taking place.
Talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, about the rainbow flag. Governor Evers proclaimed that it would fly over the state capitol. Embassies around the world have been advised not to fly it on the flagpole under the U.S. flag. They're displaying it in other ways in many cases. All that said, Kimmy, think back even just, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, the notion that this would even be an issue for debate might have seemed incredible, the idea that anyone would put up the pride flag so prominently over a government building.
10, 15 years ago, we forget that states were caught up in passing laws to ban same-sex marriage. Not only were we not talking about flying the LGBT flag, we were talking about putting in place laws that deliberately discriminated based on LGBT status. So without a doubt, you have to look at this and say, you've come a long way, baby, in a very short amount of time. What remains to be seen is what kind of backlash happens, because certainly you will see folks in Wisconsin challenge his executive decision on this. There's a little bit of case law that supports the idea that it is within his authority, But what will be interesting to see is whether your legislature takes actions to either support him or to challenge him and his authority to be able to take that action. And that will really define where we go in this debate.
Yeah, there's already a petition from at least one group aimed at challenging the governor's decision. Do you see it likely? You mentioned likely court challenges, Kimmy. Could other groups come out and say, okay, we have a flag because you've given this deference to this one flag, we feel like we have a right to that as well?
Yeah, I think you definitely will, simply because you've seen that in the context of other areas in which people want to post displays, especially public parks. Typically, when you look at the laws around the country, it's vested in whoever the leader is, the governor, the president, or whatever. But it's when you drill into those municipalities where you don't have rules and guidelines, and that's where it's going to be interesting. The other thing I want to have on people's radar is that we're hearing stories that in Seoul, South Korea, and in New Delhi, India, the embassies there defied President Trump's orders. And went ahead and flew the flag. So it will be curious to see if the president takes any actions. It certainly seemed to indicate that what Vice President Pence was saying is that the president would be okay with displays like what the ambassador in Nepal did, where he tweeted a picture of himself surrounded by the staff with pride and all the rainbow colors. Those kinds of symbolic representations seem to be okay. But whether or not defying the president's order not to fly the flag, that's going to be a different issue.
We'll watch and see what develops. Kimmy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You betcha.
That's Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. We talked with her about the Trump administration's decision to ban U.S. embassies from flying the pride flag on their flagpoles. We also discussed Governor Evers' order to fly the rainbow flag over the state capitol building during June, which is Pride Month. If you're a parent, you might have faced the battle over trying to get kids to eat healthy foods, maybe their veggies in particular. To make them a little more appealing, we might offer some salad dressing. That doesn't always work. So how about some salad frosting? Chris Molina is here with me. Chris, you pointed this story out to me. What's going on with Kraft?
Yeah, so it sounds like they're introducing a new salad dressing, or I should say salad frosting is what they're calling it, and they're using it as a way to essentially trick kids into eating their vegetables. And so I'm all for getting kids to eat their veggies, but I think that kids are going to see right through this. Rob, you're a parent. Your kids would see right through this, right?
I think so, yeah. Let's make it clear here. This container of salad frosting, I'm throwing quotes around that. What's actually in that package?
I mean, it's probably ranch dressing.
It's ranch dressing.
But if you look at the package, too, it's got like sprinkles on it. It's got bright colors. It even looks like something that you would put on a cake. Kids are going to see right through this, though.
I think so. Well, if the kid has any experience with eating frosting, which I guess if the package is going to appeal to them, you hope they do. If I'm expecting frosting and I taste ranch dressing, kid, grown up, doesn't matter. It's going to be kind of weird.
It's going to be weird. And I love ranch dressing, but it is completely different than frosting. And it is really going to put you off on it for a long time.
And part of the story here is, you know, should we lie to our kids to get them to eat food? Well, I went to Kraft's website and they have something about like parents lying to their kids campaign.
Oh, no.
Where they want you to call in write in and tell them, here's the best lie I ever told to my kid. So yes, they're embracing the deception angle. Right from the start.
Do you want to give the call-in number right now and ask people what the biggest lie they've told their kids?
Gonna be too busy going on buying some salad frosting, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rob.
This is Central Time.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The acting Homeland Security Secretary was back on Capitol Hill today. As NPR's Joel Rose explains, he pressed lawmakers